Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Causes or Cures. I'm Dr. Eakes, your host, and thanks so much for joining in to today's episode. So we are going to talk about polio today, particularly polio in Pakistan, where while polio is still endemic or regularly occurring, here in the US, we used to have regular outbreaks in the 1940s and 1950s. And then with the introduction of the polio vaccine, cases plummeted. They went down. If you listen to the podcast I did with the author of Vaccine Nation, you'll know that this was one of the vaccines that people lined up to get, and they were really excited about it because polio had the potential to be devastating, especially for kids. And people saw that. They were scared. And so they lined up for the vaccine. They wanted it. Now, some of you know this. But for those who don't, polio spreads from person to person, and it can lead to severe muscle weakness and, in some cases, paralysis. But it can affect the spinal cord, which is like your body's highway for nerve signals that allow you to feel and move your muscles, including the muscles that allow us to breathe. You guys might remember the iron lung. It was like the original respiratory machine. The first iron lung, I believe, was used in Boston at Boston Children's Hospital for a child with polio. And sometimes those whose breathing muscles were impacted by polio had to stay in the iron lung for a long time, like being immobilized in this giant metal can. But it did save a lot of lives. And by the way, if you are interested in this type of stuff, a great book you can read is 3 Minutes for a Dog: My Life in an Iron Lung by Paul Alexander. Paul got polio when he was just 6 years old, and afterwards he couldn't move. He had trouble breathing. He had to be put in an iron lung to survive, and he did survive, but he still needed the assistance of an iron lung for breathing for over 67 years. Imagine that, 67 years. And despite all that, he went to law school. He started a law practice. I mean, really, it's amazing. You know, all the small stuff we complain about. And then there's people like Paul who are in this iron lung and go to law school and then write a book. It's amazing. All right, moving on. My guest today is Dr. Anushka Atalajan, who is a professor and researcher who studies public health issues as they relate to Pakistan. And she'll tell us more about her work and what she does in the podcast. I recently read one paper she and her colleagues authored about polio eradication efforts in Pakistan. So, on today's podcast, she is going to tell us the story of polio eradication efforts in Pakistan, including different programs, initiatives they've tried, different barriers, obstacles, including how our own CIA added to vaccine hesitancy in Pakistan. People's beliefs and concerns and events that influence how they view the polio vaccine, threats of insecurity, and how that ties into all of this. And then she'll offer recommendations and insight for how to improve eradication efforts in the future. All right. So this is an interesting, timely global health topic. Polio is no joke. So give me a few seconds while we connect to our guest. All right, everybody, we are connecting with Dr. Anushka Atalajan, and we're going to talk about polio eradication. Polio's been in the news lately. We had a case in New York. We know that it's endemic, it's still around in Pakistan and Afghanistan, which are the two countries where wild poliovirus, the transmission of that has never stopped. But first, thank you so much for joining. And I read your paper, and it's a really interesting topic. So before we jump in, though, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, the work you do, your research?
Sure. So I'm an assistant professor at the School of Health Studies in the Faculty of Health Sciences at Western University. I am a critical qualitative researcher, and I draw on a variety of different critical theories to support my work. The majority of my research focuses in on Pakistan, where I look at women, children, and adolescent health. And I'm really interested in how people make the decision to obtain a specific health service, what feeds into that decision, the different ideologies. And so sometimes looking at like geopolitics, religion, and also looking at inequities and the role they play also in accessing services.
All right. So this is a true public health topic for the podcast. So I know we have the global polio eradication effort. It launched in 1988 with the goal of eradicating wild and vaccine-related polioviruses worldwide. But specific to Pakistan, there was the polio eradication program that started in 1994. I think it was funded by a few people, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, CDC. And you listed a lot of initiatives. There was a lot of programs since 1994. And I was just wondering if you could just walk us through some of those programs and also what was happening to polio as these programs were going on in time to now, I
Yeah,
guess, or whatever's easiest.
absolutely. So, yeah, exactly. So, polio has really been this global priority for the last few decades, and there has been a lot of funding that has moved into it. And so, in Pakistan, the polio eradication efforts formally started in 1994, and they were really quite successful when they first started. They dropped polio rates from about 20,000 to just a few cases. And they haven't been able to, though, in the last few years, be able to kind of just get those numbers down to zero. You know, there are some years where cases will drop, but then they do tend to spike up again. And so there have been a lot of different initiatives that the government has undertaken to try to really increase uptake of polio vaccine. And these have really reflected some of the different concerns and challenges by the community. So one of the major barriers that does come up is around religion. And so there has been advocacy efforts that have brought in religious leaders to try to get their support for polio vaccine, to use that to encourage people that obtaining polio vaccination is religiously permissible. So there have been these different plans that are undertaken every 4 to 5 years. And so currently what we are currently in is a polio end game strategy, and that is supposed to end this year. And so it's supposed to really be that final push for polio eradication. And I guess we can chat a little bit about whether that seems feasible or what are some of the obstacles that they will face kind of getting to that goal line.
Okay, so that's so right now at the end game strategy, is that really what that's what it's called?
Yeah,
Oh.
polio end game strategy. So it sounds like a little bit like a video game, but
Well, I mean, it's clear what you know that they're like now is the time. So from 1994, then the case it was very successful early on, and then there was different changes, and you know we're gonna get into some of those. So I wanted to kind of focus on the barriers because I think that's what you know. It was most interesting, you know, just to in different places of the world, there's different things going on that play into, like you mentioned at the beginning, you know, the decision to get vaccinated or the access to the polio vaccine. So let's talk about you in your paper, you broke it down into sections, one of them being caregivers, believers, and knowledge. And I was curious if who do you mean by caregivers? And then maybe can you talk through some of those?
Yeah, so what's really interesting, I think, specifically when we think about the Pakistani context, is that a lot of health decisions aren't necessarily just made by that person in isolation. So when we are talking about a child's health, it's not just the parents who are often making that decision. It's there's quite a big role that grandparents also play in informing those decisions. So when we're talking about caregivers, we're talking about the parents, but we're also talking about the wider family network. A lot of individuals also live in a joint family system. So where you're living with, like, usually it's the husband's parents and then his brothers and their wives, they're all living in one shared household. So all of that can really, all of the different perspectives from the different relatives can all play a role in influencing polio vaccination decisions.
And that makes sense. And some of the concerns I was reading about, you see these concerns, you know, here with COVID circulating, and I've seen them when you read about different, you know, people who don't want to get vaccinated, with other vaccines here. But one of them was like fertility concerns. Is that still pretty prevalent? Really? Okay.
It is quite prevalent. So when we think about the types of Concerns that people really cite. They're really, we can think about them with respect to like them being demographic, being geopolitical, and also being religious. And I like to talk about them all together because they are really quite connected. So a lot of the demographic concerns around fertility are also deeply tied to geopolitical concerns as well. And so really thinking about the role of foreign governments in these programs, supporting these programs, and concerns that people have about the potential ulterior motives of these types of programs. And then when we contextualize this with the insecurity that is happening in the region and the fact that there are really foreign forces that are engaged in military operations in some areas of Pakistan and also in Afghanistan, we can start to understand why individuals may question foreign involvement in this. And there's also within that, there also have been experiences that have really validated people's concerns. In 2012, of course, as we know, there was a campaign to kill Osama bin Laden, and there was a fake hepatitis campaign that was used to identify where he is. And so campaigns like that then really just continue to fracture individuals' trust in these health programs and really what the motive is of these health programs as well.
Right, and just to remind people, that was that fake vaccination campaign was run by the CIA, the American CIA. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it was a hepatitis B vaccine, but they were also collecting DNA on the children to try to link a relative to Osama bin Laden. So you can totally see how that would create massive distrust, and that's a valid reason, And I think after that, the president, you might know, Obama was like, they can no longer use these. The CIA can't use these vaccination campaigns. But it's the CIA, we don't know. But hopefully they're not. But that's true. And after that, and from your paper, you do write a lot about, like the healthcare workers and the people doing the vaccination. They didn't feel safe. There was attacks on them. Was that related to this? And there was like no vaccination laws.
So there have been attacks on health workers for an extended period of time, and it's I wouldn't say kind of that it was causal, that it was exactly related to this, but I think that there has been this growing sort of mistrust in the program and increasing experiences of violence that health workers have experienced when trying to deliver care. And then this is really basically meant that there are certain areas that are entirely inaccessible for healthcare workers who are giving polio vaccines. And they do experience a lot of violence, a lot of insecurity as they are just delivering these services. And so there have been police that often accompany them, but then one can bring into question about how does that then just sort of further reinforce questions that people have about the program.
Sure. What about the need for the vaccine? And I feel like this ties into communicating with people and getting them, using trusted messengers. We hear that phrase a lot in public health, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think this is an area where I have quite a few thoughts on it actually, because I think that polio vaccine, there has been this really big emphasis on polio vaccine and vaccinating children against polio. And when I've gone into communities and I've done some community-based work around this that I'm still working to get out and publish, but when I've spoken to people, a lot of times what they are saying is that this isn't a priority for us. This isn't actually what is at the top of our list. People are talking about the fact that, there's a lot of food insecurity. They're talking about the fact that their streets are completely littered with garbage and that it's unsanitary. They're talking about the fact that they can't access other health services. So there is really this misalignment. And I think this is part of when we have these vertical programs that are really pushing one specific health service without like providing this more holistic approach to health, that can also further resistance as well. And I do some work on family planning in another capacity too, also in the Pakistani context, and we see that with the family planning program too, where similar types of concerns. So what people are speaking to oftentimes when they're talking about like the mistrust is this question of like, well, why this program? Because what we're seeing in our day-to-day lives doesn't reflect that this is a key problem.
That makes sense. It's kind of like we have bigger issues and we want this, and people just keep pushing this one thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And when we think about, there have been a lot of efforts to try to get community leaders and community health workers on side, and they have been successful in some capacities. But a lot of that is there are people that are like still refusers, continuous refusers, that just continue to not refuse, and those people are the hardest people to like move the dial on.
Yeah, that's you want people, and I guess in the movable middle, who like anywhere to make a decision. Can you talk? One thing you mentioned in your paper was the dialogue around religion related to the polio vaccine, and you mentioned it was reductive. Or can you
Yeah.
talk a little more about that? Like, how does religion tie into this? Is it
Yeah.
you know yeah.
So a lot of the concerns around the polio vaccine itself are related to the fact that people worry that there may be ingredients in it that are not halal. So things, they'll say that there's like urine in it, they'll say that there's pig products in it. And I've been in contacts in people's households where they've said, like, my ex relative works at this place and they saw it and so there's a lot of like that concern that they're being forced to ingest something that is religiously impermissible. And I think that what my comment about the conversation about religion being reductive, the way that we talk about religion being slightly reductive is related to the fact that I think that we need to move beyond this conversation about if something is permissible or not permissible, but really start to think about the ways that people are negotiating religious beliefs. And I think this really ties into sometimes the stereotypes that we have about autonomy and who we really equate autonomy with. And so when we think about rural dwelling folks who are Muslim, those aren't usually the people that we think about as like empowered. And I say this as somebody who comes like comes to this from really as a Muslim woman who often has their autonomy denied. And when we think about it kind of like in the global conversations, and we can see this how it relates to conversations around scarf and veiling, et cetera, right? And so what I'm saying is that we really need to think about how are people engaging with their religious beliefs? How are they negotiating it? And not necessarily just say, oh, somebody thinks something's religiously impermissible, so that means that it's going to be something that they will avoid. Because that doesn't really make space for people to make their own decisions.
And that makes sense. Yeah, and I think too, like what goes into someone actually making a decision. There's all like there's the factors. They're all like interacting with one another, and it's kind of hard to tell what's gonna be, the most influential factor, so to speak.
Absolutely. And like there's we know that there's so many different registers that feed into any type of decision that we make. And even our concept of what we consider moral is not just entirely informed by religion. Religion, for those who practice, can be one consideration, but there's all a whole host of other considerations that also come into that space.
All right. And I like how you're tying this all together. So let's now you mentioned that tailored messaging is important for local communities. And I see that a lot in the work I do. I feel like a lot of the times when a public health campaign fails, it doesn't connect with people. So you're not necessarily understanding your or you're not connecting to them in the sense that what they think matters is not what you want them to think matters. So for example, like, hey guys, we need food or clean water. Like, we don't need this vaccine. Like, maybe focus on the bigger picture. Like, I can see that. But what is there an example of, like a message that worked or a message that didn't work or something from your experience where you saw a communication initiative that said, oh, this worked?
Yeah, so maybe I can speak a little bit to like what the government is doing now. And so a lot of the polio cases that we are currently seeing in Pakistan, it has really centered around Pakhtun or Pashtun populations. And this really brings in this other element that related to ethnic marginalization, ethnic discrimination, and the fact that when we talk about Pakhtuns within the Pakistani context, that they often feel that they are not really supported by the Pakistani state. And they're also the tribe is mainly in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, that province, and then also in parts of Balochistan. So it's also areas where there have been increased experiences of insecurity as well, which has continued to reinforce this feeling that the state's not taking care of them. And so there has been some concerted effort by the government now to involve Pashtun influencers and people that are, really prominent in those communities to try to get them to be able to sway the population and encourage them to uptake the vaccine.
Okay, and since we're you mentioned government in your paper, you had a section about the oversight of the programs, and for example, the staff felt that they weren't properly compensated or trained. Can you speak a little bit to that in terms of some of the barriers there that work against polio eradication?
Yeah, there just is many of the staff members, the healthcare workers that are doing this type of work. As I said earlier, they are experiencing increased insecurity, really working in really difficult conditions. But at the same time, often they are having delays with being able to access their payments. They're not compensated in a correct way. They're overloaded because this polio campaigns can be, depending on what role you're in, can be only one part of the job that you're doing. So lady health workers who are really heavily engaged in polio vaccination efforts, they also are providing door-to-door care to women and children. And so like letting women know, where they can get their ANC or where they can get their contraceptives. So that's also another part of their job. So they're really pulled in a many, many different ways, and then also working in these really tough conditions.
And the transportation, for example, like the COVID-19 vaccines, they were talking about in some parts of the world, they require those specialized freezers, and you can't really scale that up in many parts of the world. But can you speak a little bit to how the polio vaccine is actually like transported on the ground and any issues you see with that?
Yeah, so I mean, to be perfectly honest, that's not an area that I'm like super, super
Right, yeah.
familiar.
No worries.
Okay.
Any comments are
Okay.
but then I mean, for example, one thing in your paper you mentioned like people sometimes just don't have fuel or the transportation to get where they need to go.
Yeah,
So.
and I think that's a this speaks to the fact that there's just although there have been a lot of funds that have been put into polio vaccination efforts, that there are still gaps. And there is still the need for further funding. And I think this then kind of brings in this question where I think there's a fair amount of donor fatigue as well. The polio eradication efforts have really been in this last push for a long time. And so there are a lot of other concerns globally. And we think about things like, COVID-19, of course, it's at the top of everybody's mind. So where are the resources really going to be put? And where should the resources be put? Which are larger questions that I think a lot of folks that are working on a global context are really grappling with.
How did and this obviously was not in your paper, but with COVID-19, how did Pakistan do in your opinion? Is it have things calmed down?
Yeah, so there has been, I mean, that there were vaccines available and folks did get vaccinated. I was actually just there in January. So what I can say sort of from an anecdotal perspective is that, life has kind of resumed back to normal. And I think people have just accepted that COVID is just part of the new reality that people are going to have to deal with. With respect to polio vaccine, there were big disruptions in the polio campaigns. There were several months where polio vaccines were disrupted, and also that resources were pulled from the polio program to support with COVID-19 vaccination efforts as well.
And that makes sense. I think that happened a lot of places. Just everything was just going towards COVID, and so many things just took a back seat. And
Yeah, absolutely.
yeah, and now we're all like, oh no, we made all bigger problems in all these other areas. As the world goes, as the world turns. So the other thing you mentioned was climate and insecurity threats, and these are all connected, as you mentioned. But I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit more about that.
So, I mean, the climate change has just is a new reality that we're just really going to have to contend with in the Pakistani context, with in terms of the impact that it's having on populations. If you followed the news last year, Pakistan experienced extreme flooding last summer. And some of this was due to unseasonably high monsoon rains, and some of it, specifically in the province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, was related to glacial melts. And Pakistan, actually, outside of the polar regions, it houses the most glaciers in the world. So it's something like 72,000 glaciers.
Did not know
So,
that.
yeah, it's a fact that most people are usually surprised about, but
Yeah.
when we start to think about climate change and we start to think about what's that going to mean long term for the Pakistani population, the frequency of these types of floods and these types of events will probably also increase. And not only does that lead to people living in conditions that are oftentimes unsanitary, where not only polio but other infectious diseases really do spread quite rampantly, but also high levels of displacement. And that can be a really large problem for anybody that is trying to ensure that children are getting immunized. So it can be a concern that will not just extend to polio, but also potentially extend to other infectious disease as well. And we've seen that in other humanitarian crises, that there can be these rises of other infectious disease. And then with insecurity is also becoming an increasing concern. As things get more insecure in Afghanistan, this tends to have a spillover effect into Pakistan. So as I was talking about earlier, the Pakhtun population that is in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and Balochistan is also in Afghanistan. So the border between the countries in some areas is quite porous. Individuals do come back and forth between there. There's actually an agreement with the Pakistani government that Afghan citizens can come into Pakistan for medical care and leave. So there is quite a lot of like back and forth between those populations. And as things have also gotten worse in Afghanistan, we have seen increased refugees coming in from Afghanistan too. And at the same time, part of the insecurity in Afghanistan, I think, has emboldened some terrorist elements in the Pakistani context too. So we saw just in January in Peshawar, there was an explosion in a mosque there. And this is starting to, unfortunately, be part of a larger trend of more insecurity. So things had quieted down quite a bit in Pakistan, and now the insecurity is starting to increase as well. And we know from the past that it's very difficult to reach children in these insecure areas. And if we look at things such as like in 2012, there was a ban in the Thira Valley where no polio workers were allowed to enter that valley to vaccinate any children. And it was something like, I think it was close to 200,000 children that were at risk of polio because no, they weren't able to get vaccinated. So there are those concerns too, that as insecurity continues to increase in the country, what are going to be the impacts for access to children, people being able to access care, and then of course the impacts just largely on health sort of as a whole.
Right, and you mentioned I was thinking in your paper too, where what happens in Afghanistan will, affect polio eradication efforts in Pakistan because they sh the border. Are there efforts happening in Afghanistan? I mean, I thought there were doing something with like trying polio eradication there, but then I, to be honest, I lost track. I didn't know anymore, but.
I know that there has been efforts, polio eradication efforts in Afghanistan. The extent to which they have been able to reach children, and if there are children being missed by the campaign, the amount of children, I'm not really sure.
Right. But you do know there is increased terrorism activity, which is tied to instability. And that,
Exactly.
you know. Okay. Are people, I guess, well, I don't want to say trust the vaccine, but maybe, you know what, let me just let forget that question. That's not a good question. Because it's not, the question is not happening in my brain. So in your opinion, based on your experience and your research, solution, what are some things solution-wise or recommendations, in a perfect world, or if you were in charge, what do you think would make the biggest difference?
Yeah, so I think that this whole point about trust is actually really, really important. And when we are thinking about the ways that people sort of are have concerns about or fears related to the vaccine, that's actually reflecting some deep-seated concerns and mistrust in not only the vaccine, but really in the government and the ability or willingness of the government to protect its citizens. So I think that what really needs to be done is really start to rebuild that trust. And part of that is related to the fact that people are not able to access other services from the government in a way that is really easy. So thinking about how can there be a wider approach to health? How can we provide more holistic health services? How can that then continue to create that trust for citizens in the state, and then that lead to increased vaccination rates? And what's really interesting is I've done some work with Dr. Zulfikar Bhutta, who has done some really interesting work in Pakistan, looking at the role of these health camps where they provide holistic health services to individuals, and the role that that has had in increasing polio vaccine uptake. And so I think that there are some really good examples of what can be done, but of course they are resource intensive. And it's that is, I think, the difficulty for the Pakistani government is really being able to provide those types of care and services at a mass scale requires a lot of investment for a government that is in not such a great financial situation, especially right now.
And that makes sense. And I think I totally agree with you. And I think, sometimes we go in there with like the misinformation armies and that kind of thing, but really the focus should be on how do you build trust? Because that really is what it boils down to.
Yeah, and for many children, when they get their polio vaccine, sometimes that can be the first time that they've ever interacted with the health system. And so that's really just showing you like where the gap is and where there needs to be more continued effort.
Right. And that makes sense. People probably go in there like, well, we're going to eradicate this, but you have to remember that you're dealing with people who may not trust you, and their perspective matters, and you can't just come running in here and expect people to just go along with stuff.
Yeah, and one of the things that we haven't really had a chance to chat about too much is actually the way that there has also been the involvement of security forces related to polio vaccination as well. So parents that refuse to let their children be vaccinated can actually now be they can be like they can there can be action taken against them, and this is hasn't been invoked too much, but it has been invoked in a few different contexts in Mardan and in Charsada and in Peshawar. where there has actually been action taken against people. And then that can also lead to further resistance and further that mistrust as well.
When you mean action taken, the security forces come, they are force the parents to do something, or they arrest them, or
Yep, they arrest them. Yeah.
wow. And
Yeah.
then wow. Yeah, I can't imagine that being good for trust in the long
Yeah.
run. That's my take anyways, just
Yeah, no,
on a
I
very human
100% agree
level.
with
I
you.
feel like like you can't coerce someone into trusting. yeah, interesting. Wow. Yeah, in general, I'm against like the force, and you know, with any, I think it really comes down to connecting to people and hearing them and communicating. Now, do you think, just you know, and this is not a, this is just, what do you think? A question that doesn't need to be any like research or evidence or anything, but do you think that we will get there, where this will be eradicated? And I know there are issues with the, you know, the oral vaccine, and some cases of polio coming from the vaccine, particularly in areas that had very low vaccination rates. But that's a different story. I know public health people are working on that issue right now, but do you think that this is a foreseeable goal, that we could eradicate this? Do you think it's trending in the right direction?
Yeah, so there had been a lot of progress last in 2021. I believe we had 0 cases, and then in 2022 we've now seen a jump to 20 cases. So far in 2023 there haven't been any polio cases in Pakistan, so that's positive, but generally you do tend to see more cases like later in the year. So I think there is the possibility to really get there and to really eradicate polio. But I think there has to be not only just national will, but global will. And there has to be some really grassroots work and initiatives that are done to really get us across that final finish line. And I think it's really hard from a global perspective, where I think there are a lot of other concerns which are really diverting resources, and polio is not a top global priority right now. I'm curious though to see, as we are starting to see some cases in the US, and I believe there was also some in the UK, if that will reinvigorate interest in polio and potentially the resources and attention that's being directed towards polio. That'll be interesting to see in the future.
Yes. And that usually does happen. That's the United States is like, oh no, there's something here. Like we have
Yeah.
to, that's yes. Well, this was great. Now, are you, you mentioned a couple other papers that you're working on. Are you doing more research in this area or another aspect?
Yeah, so some of my new work, I've started to do some work actually on climate change in Pakistan now, because it is becoming such a pressing concern that I think that any other health work that one does in the country has to re really contextualize against that backdrop, because it's going to continue to just worsen and be at the forefront. So looking at the gendered impacts of climate change, and looking at their influence on women's health, well-being, but also how it's shifted gender norms and roles. And this is specifically focusing on the Swat Valley, because that experienced a fair amount of the flooding in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa over the last year.
Oh, interesting. I mean, there's so many problems in the world. It's like climate change, polio. Yeah, you're just I don't know. We have, I guess people who are working in public health have a lot to keep them busy anyways.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to one day be out of a job, but with the way things are going, I don't think that I'm going to be anytime soon.
Yeah. No, but this is good. I just hope that there is like more of a renewed, you know, push for prevention, you know, prevention that actually works. instead of, kind of like gesturing or just talking about it, which is kind of like one of the goals I had with this podcast, is just to bring people on who are like boots on the ground, so to speak, who are seeing things, who can, talk about things. And we're all connected too. Like what happens in Pakistan affects what happens in the United States, what happens, everywhere is, now we're all so connected, but we'll see. We'll see if we can get there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that COVID-19 has actually made very, very clear is that we are so connected. And we can't ignore it. It's the way that what's happening in another part of the world is directly impacting us. And a lot of the big health crises that we will be contending with in the next few years will require global efforts. And climate change is a great example of that.
Yeah, and with climate change too, that by itself it's a risk factor for a new emerging infectious disease. I mean, you could just see that, like basic example would be a mosquito can just like all of a sudden live in a new area because of the changing temperature, and then you have a vector-borne illness. Yeah. So
100%, yeah.
thank you so much. This was really interesting.
You.
And it was great to read your research, and I wish you a lot of luck in stay in touch, definitely. I'm so interested in, I read a lot about, like, I mean, polio is such a, it's such a devastating illness, and for kids, and when you see, you go through history books and you see some of those pictures of like iron lungs, and you're just like, oh my gosh, like you could like stop that. But it's hard.
Yeah,
It's not easy.
absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, in the Pakistani context, a lot of like the impacts of polio are not so far removed. Like I think of people in my parents' generation, and a lot of them either knew somebody that had it or know someone that is still dealing with some of the like long-term impacts. So yeah, if we can kind of decrease those for anybody, that's a win.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad we got to connect.
Yes, me too. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast, and it was
Yes, this
wonderful
is
to chat with
great.
you. Thank
Enjoy the
you.
rest of your day there.
You too.
Okay.
You too.
Bye
Take care. Bye.
bye. All right. Thank you, everybody, for joining in to today's podcast. I hope you found it interesting and perhaps learned something. I know I did. That's a big reason I do this podcast, honestly, because I always learn something new. And I like to hear about what's going on in other countries, not just America. Not just America, America. Okay. Please feel free to share your thoughts, and you can reach me on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or through my website slash blog. I don't really know which one it is. Bloomingwellness.com, where I do some writing. And there's some also other people write stuff there, but they're like more ads, and usually they're not good. They're terrible, but they help support Barnaby, my dog's treat habit. So there we are. You can also subscribe to my newsletter from my website. And now, to close out the episode with a quote, this is from Jonas Salk, the inventor of one of the polio vaccines. And people have very different opinions about what he says here, which is cool. But in April of 1955, Edward Murrow asked Dr. Salk, who owned the patent to the polio vaccine? And Salk famously responded, well, the people, I would say. There is no patent. Could you patent the sun? It's interesting to think about that, especially in today's world, especially in the US, where like stuff, healthcare, medication is so unaffordable. Yeah. Anyways, that's another podcast. Okay, guys, I hope you tune in next time. Till then, go out there and do good things and look up from your cell phones every now and then so you can see the oncoming perils such as buses and whatnot. All right. I'm really bad with endings. Okay. See you soon. Bye-bye.